And what a wonderful day it is to be here to worship together. A very special occasion. There are times when you want to enter into this place and preach because there's a word that's burning within you. And there are times when it's a little intimidating. Sometimes that's because you don't want to get in the way of where the Spirit is already moving. I kind of feel like that today. Nevertheless, as Luther would say, I shall sin boldly today. So let's dive in and see if I can enter into our worship as well. We are going to focus today in Exodus 16. We're continuing our series that we've been doing on the people in the wilderness and God's faithfulness to them. And today we have a very interesting story that we'll be looking at that has occurred to them here in Exodus 16. And while I am going to focus on a few ideas from that passage, I'd like us to start at least by taking maybe a little bit more of the 30,000-foot view. So let's read a few more extended verses from the chapter so we can have a little bit more of that story in our minds as we go. This is Exodus 16. Now the whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. On the sixth day they are to prepare what they bring in, and that is to be twice as much as they gather on the other days." So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, "In the evening you will know that it was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt. And in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard you grumbling against him. Who are we that you should grumble against us?" Moses also said, "You will know that it was the Lord when he gives you meat to eat in the evening and all the bread you want in the morning, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we? You are not grumbling against us, but against the Lord." Then Moses told Aaron, "Say to the entire Israelite community, come before the Lord. He has heard your grumbling." While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked toward the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. The Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God." That evening, quail came and covered the camp. And in the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, "It is the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Each one is to gather as much as he needs. Take an omer for each person you have in your tent." The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some little. And when they measured it by the omer, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little. Each one gathered as much as he needed. Then Moses said to them, "No one is to keep any of it until morning." However, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning because it was full of maggots and it began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. Each morning, everyone gathered as much as he needed, and when the sun grew hot, it melted away. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, two omers for each person, and the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. He said to them, "This is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil, save whatever is left, and keep it until morning." So they saved it until morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink or get maggots in it. "Eat it today," Moses said, "because today is a Sabbath to the Lord. You will not find any of it on the ground today. 6 days you are to gather it. But on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will not be any. Nevertheless, some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather it, but they found none. Then the Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commands and my instructions? Bear in mind that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. This is why on the sixth day he gives you bread for 2 days. Everyone is to stay where he is on the seventh day. No one is to go out." So the people rested on the seventh day. The people of Israel called the bread manna. It was white like coriander seed and tasted like wafers made with honey. Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Take an omer of manna and keep it for the generations to come, so that they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the desert when I brought you out of Egypt." So Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar and put an omer of manna in it. Then place it before the Lord to be kept for the generations to come." As the Lord commanded Moses, Aaron put the manna in front of the testimony that it might be kept. The Israelites ate the manna for 40 years until they came to a land that was settled. They ate the manna until they reached the border of Canaan. Let's pray just for a moment. Our God, despite your people's hardened hearts, you gave them manna when they were hungry. So soften our hearts and make us grateful for your marvelous gifts. Amen. Well, by now you probably have heard me preach enough to know that I like stories and storytelling. I especially like stories that, given a little bit of examination, show us something about ourselves that is, as Malcolm Gladwell might say, overlooked or somehow misunderstood. One of my favorite genres for stories that do that very kind of thing are folk tales. Take, for example, an African folk tale called The Hare and the Lion. This story is an example of what you might call a trickster tale, where the protagonist is usually a bit of an underdog, smaller in stature, otherwise lesser than the opponent in the story. These are common in other cultures as well. The Europeans had the sly fox. The Native Americans in the Southwest had the clever coyote. In Africa, you had Anansi the spider and the hare. The trickster usually outwits their opponent, and usually the opponent comes to a rather bad end. So here is the story of the hare and the lion. The hare one day is going along while lion was hunting. And the lion said, "I want to swallow you." And hare answered, "Ha ha ha, if you eat me, I'm a very small animal. My meat will not be enough to satisfy you. But if you will just wait for me here at this place, I'll go to the mountain over there, and I will run and I will chase some big animals and I will drive them to this side. And you just have to stand here and keep your mouth open, and you will catch them when they come by." Well, the lion agreed to do everything that the hare said to do. So the hare climbed up the mountain, and as he climbed, he began to throw small stones, and they lodged themselves under a fairly large boulder. And all the while he was doing this, he shouted, be ready, lion, I'm coming. Are you ready?" Finally, he just asked, "Have you had enough of this?" The lion said, "Not at all. I am ready." And so finally, with all the small stones, the large boulder came free, and it began to roll down the mountain. It rumbled, and it sounded like a large creature. Hare told the lion to be ready to receive a large buffalo. And so the lion kept his mouth wide open. The stone rumbled down the mountain until it hit the lion and it killed him. And the hare asked, "Have you had enough now?" He found that there was no reply. So he went down to the place where the lion was, and he found that the lion was dead. The hare was celebrating, and all the other animals came out to see about the lion's fate. And the hare was praised for killing their enemy. Now, the structure of this particular story makes figuring out the meaning rather straightforward. The lion, wanting more than the small bite of the hare, allowed himself to literally be killed by his appetite. His insatiable greed and hunger became his undoing. That's a common lesson and one that appears in other folk tales. Aesop has a tale called The Flies and the Honey Pot. And in that story, a jar of honey is overturned in a housekeeper's room, and seeing their great fortune, the flies swarm onto the honey, and they land on it for what is to them a magnificent feast. But in landing on the honey, they fail to notice that while they eat, their legs and their wings become so entangled with the honey that they are now useless, and the flies become stuck, and they suffocate. Aesop ends the story with the flies exclaiming, "Oh, foolish creatures that we are, for the sake of a little pleasure, we have destroyed ourselves." Now, both of these stories speak to an age-old human frailty, the failing of greed, and the path of destruction that consumption without ceasing can bring on us. And we'd find it hard to argue that in either one of these stories, the lion or the flies are in any way a model or an inspirational kind of figure. Which makes it all the more interesting that the 1986 movie Wall Street became a source of inspiration for investment bankers and stockbrokers galore. According to interviews conducted with Michael Douglas and Charlie Sheen and Oliver Stone, who were involved in the original movie, when the sequel came out in 2010, people had been coming up to them literally for decades to talk about their characters in the movie and how that inspired them to join the field all through the 80s and the 90s. If you haven't seen that movie, or if you haven't seen it in a while, Michael Douglas plays Gordon Gekko. He's a wealthy and unscrupulous corporate raider. And Charlie Sheen is Bud Fox, who is his would-be protege. He tries to get Gekko to teach him. He wants to aid Gekko in all his financial dealings. And ultimately, he gets caught up in a scheme of insider trading, but not before trapping Gekko into a confession that will also send him to jail. It's a story where everyone, in the end, becomes the bad guy. The movie is really meant to be a criticism of the excesses of the 1980s. And there's a very significant and famous scene in the movie where Gekko is speaking to the shareholders of Teldar Paper, a company he's trying to take over. The move that he wants the shareholders to approve will make a few of them a little bit of money, but it'll make Gekko a lot of money because he's the majority shareholder in the company. He will see just enormous gains. He justifies his actions to all of them with what is a very famous speech. "The point is, ladies and gentlemen," he says, "the point is greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies. It cuts through. It captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, for knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind." Later in the movie, Bud finds out that Gordon Gekko is essentially double-crossing him. He's going to buy and then shut down Blue Star Airlines, a company that Bud's father, among others, works for, and he feels betrayed because this was not a part of the plan. And he asks Gordon, "When is it all end, Gordon? How many yachts can you water ski behind? How much is enough?" The questions are there expressing Bud's disillusionment for consequences that he never envisioned beyond his own benefits and his own success. Now, that movie was intended as a cautionary tale on the pitfalls of unchecked ambition and greed, but instead it had the quality of turning Douglas's very charismatic and, by the way, Oscar-winning villain, Gordon Gekko, into a household name. and a boardroom icon, a model, even though for everyone he set such a terrible example. Gordon's answer to Bud is not necessarily that it's not a question about enough. It's the notion, he says, of who's going to win and who's going to lose. Some people are going to end up with money and some people are not, and I'm just more deserving, basically, he says. Life, to Gordon Gekko, is all about greed and self-sufficiency. And Bud, in the movie, has to determine if that's enough for him. It's a question he struggles with, especially when he sees people he knows hurt by his actions. Now, before I get too far into this, I want to be clear that in general, there isn't, in fact, anything wrong with ownership or possessions or even the desire to have goods or money. It does become aberrant, though, when the fulfillment of your responsibilities or when stinginess in sharing overtakes those kinds of desires and it becomes unreasonable. At some point, the desire to accumulate wealth moved from what was a potentially dangerous vice to a shining example of virtue. Gordon Gekko reminded his audience in Wall Street that amassing wealth fuels major economies, helping everyone, even perhaps the poor. It frees people from dependencies. It encourages discipline. Perhaps it even expands creativity and freedom. The formerly deadly sin of greed has moved in many people's minds to be absolved of any of its guilt. Greed and its close friend envy are examples of responses to anxiety. It's that generalized, targetless kind of worry about the future. Greed is the answer to Bud Fox's dilemma of what's enough. It can't be enough because I don't know what comes next. If I'm going to make it on my own, I have to have more. That sounds like careful planning, right? What if my resources dry up? I need to be able to take care of myself and my family. This is a good thing, right? I've got to be able to make it on my own. And in a lot of ways, that's the dilemma that's faced by the people in our text from Exodus today. We've been following people in this journey out of Egypt, wandering in the desert. This is at least the third time that they've been halted by their complaints. The first time was when they were trapped between Pharaoh's army and the sea. God's response was that, "I will fight for you." And God led them over the dry land and swallowed their enemies by the sea. Last week, Christopher noted that the complaints the people had was that they were thirsty, and the water that God gave them was bitter. So God provided a tree, and the tree healed the water, and it was intended to heal their spirits. Today, we see that immediacy has once again overwhelmed the people, taking away their sense of long-term well-being, or even their sense of the presence of God being with them. They're hungry, and hunger led to complaining, grumbling, as it said in our text over and over. This is a story, in part at least, about the people's complaints. Here they are, stuck in the wilderness, and they're overcome by a bit of false history. See, back in Egypt, they claim, everything was fine. They sat beside overflowing cooking pots that were full of meat. They bred until they were full. Why is it that Moses has brought them out into the desert, if not to forced them to starve to death? Egypt would have been preferable because at least they wouldn't have been hungry. I especially like the way that the Message, Eugene Peterson in the Message, retells part of the second version of this story in the book of Numbers. It goes like this: the misfits among the people had a craving, and soon all the people of Israel were whining, "Why can't we have meat? We have fish in Egypt, and we got it for free." To say nothing of the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. On the surface, this complaint is about food. But it's actually a lot more serious than that. Yearning for food is not in itself a problem. The people need to be fed to be sustained. But listen again to what their complaint is. It's in verse 3. You have brought us out into the desert to starve this entire assembly to death. What the people are objecting to is the fact that God has chosen them. The way is going to be hard from here on out. They complained in Egypt, and God heard their cry and released them from their bondage and their slavery and their suffering, and they were eager for freedom when it cost them nothing. Now that it makes demands on them, it appears to be just a little too expensive. The truth of their situation is yearning for food is not their problem. Moses shows them a new way and teaches them to expect their food from another source, the God who rescued them. God's response to the people's grumbling is important in at least kind of two phases. So rather than raining down judgment on people for complaining or being angry with them, God instead rains down grace in the form of food. There'll be quail for meat in the evening, and manna every morning. Manna, as the text notes for us later, is a Hebrew compound word for with ma and who, two pronouns actually, what and he or it. Ma, na, what is it? So to call this substance manna is to say something on the order is, what does God mean by giving us that stuff? Even though both meat and bread are mentioned here in this story, the text's main concern for today and our main concern will be about the bread that falls from heaven each morning. The presence of manna shows without a doubt that God is listening to them and knows that the people's grumbling is not about Moses, but it's about God. God hears and God responds. If you wanted a simple message about this story, that's it. We could stop right here. But this isn't exactly a simple story. The second phase of God's response is that the gift of manna comes accompanied with a test. Or perhaps it's probably better to say the manna in and of itself is a test. The manna is to be gathered and used in a very particular kind of way. The people are to go out and gather enough manna for each day. Concealed in the instructions is a promise. There will be enough for that day. Those who don't gather enough will find that their supply is expanded. Those who gather more than their fair share or try to keep it will find that it rots and it's useless by the next day. If they take too much, they'll have just enough. But if they stock some away, it'll be no good. Will the people do what they are asked, no more and no less? Old Testament scholars know, probably not. What we know initially is that the questions began to arise immediately among them. They were confused by what this manna was, to the point that they named it a question. And Moses' answer to the question is to tell them that it's the bread that God has given them. There's a lot of info available about what manna actually might be and how people can still find it today, or you can even purchase it. Feel free to look it up online. The important thing for our purposes today is to note the contrast with what the people describe themselves as having left. Lavish food, freely available, in abundance, all provided by their Egyptian masters. What Moses says is that God has given them this food. But really, it's rather simple. It's ordinary. This small, flaky substance, it's useful, but it's not amazing. It is and will become a basic staple of the diet for the people while they're in the wilderness. They'll eat it the whole time they're there. It's as plain as ordinary as sliced white bread. And perhaps that's part of the problem. Something so ordinary wasn't exactly inspiring, at least for some of the people. Perhaps it was just boring. After 6 days, some of them don't even want to bother collecting it, so they don't get enough. Fortunately, they're going to have enough anyway. What we know is that some people decided that it wasn't valuable. They didn't collect it, and yet they still had enough. It's like it's everywhere. Worse, on the seventh day, some, maybe just kind of hoping something else might happen, go out to collect it, and there's none actually available. It's not there. It turned out that was just what God had promised. Not collecting enough or going out at the wrong time. This is evidence of a particular lack of trust that the bread supplied by God for this day will be daily bread. That lack of trust is intensified when the people go on to collect on the day that God says not to. Now it's not here. How can I believe that this is going to be daily bread? It isn't there today. What we see is the people's anxiety, their worry coming to the foreground. It leads them to doubt God's basic provision and care for them. It would seem hard to believe that the people who sang a song of victory at the sea could now believe that God has brought them into the desert to starve them to death with such a boring supply of bread. It would be hard to believe that if we didn't see the same tendency in ourselves. Psalm 78 is particularly instructive here. Listen to verses 23 through 25. Yet he gave a command to the skies above and opened the doors of the heavens. He rained down manna for the people to eat. He gave them the grain of heaven. Human beings ate the bread of angels. He sent them all the food they could eat. The psalm writer goes right to the heart of the matter. They didn't trust God. The Israelites could not be satisfied, not even with the bread of the angels, the bread of heaven. And we are no different. We long for and we pray for amazing, extraordinary things to happen, to make God's presence known to us and to the world in some kind of dramatic fashion. I think at times we've lost the ability to see the normal, the ordinary, as something special. I'll tell you, a sunrise, even when it's viewed from my neighborhood streets when I walk my dog Franklin early in the morning, is still a pretty amazing thing. What would it be like to consider that everything is part of God's provision for us? Eating a tomato fresh from our own garden, a toaster, the way grass smells right after it's been cut. Just because something is part of our ordinary lives doesn't mean it is not miraculous. When we wake up to discover God's steady, daily, restorative care for us and the world, hope is renewed. Faith is reborn. But the people saw ordinary and less than satisfying, and the bread could not sustain them. And so another response was that some people began to hoard what they were given every day. Some people gathered more than they were told, and by the next morning it smelled and it had bred maggots. This is less from anxiety and more from greed, I would say, but it evidences the same lack of kind of trust in God, not believing that today's bread will be back tomorrow. Some chose to take more than they needed. Some people found that their supply, even with that, was just enough, so they would start stashing some away, trying to save for a rainy day, but the food was no good for them. The question again, would today's bread be daily bread? This is the mode of thinking for people like Gordon Gekko, who believe in the scarcity of resources. It's a zero-sum game, you see. Some people are going to have it, and others aren't. Greed and a lust for more was and continues to be a significant sin for the human heart. Make no mistake, it is indisputably one of our problems. No society in the history of the world has lived as far above subsistence as we do. And there is no doubt that the earth cannot indefinitely sustain the burden that our lifestyle places on it. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, says the Psalms. Our craving for more than enough is wreaking havoc on a global scale, but it's equally devastating on a spiritual level. Against all odds, everyone had enough, malcontents included. Walter Brueggemann challenges us to relearn what he calls the lyric of abundance. It believes that there's more than enough food to go around in God's good creation. The manna story today warns against hoarding, against greed that capitalizes on this myth of scarcity in our minds. Instead, it encourages sharing. It's exemplified also in the stories that tell of Jesus taking 5 small loaves and 2 fish. And after he had blessed the food, he broke it and he gave it to feed a multitude of hungry people. God's provision of food, first evident here in this story, is repeated in the 12 baskets of bread left over after feeding a multitude of people. It shows that the abundance comes from God's presence. But the people saw a limited supply, and they took what they wanted, leaving others to fend for themselves. Now, let's not forget, too, the other provision here for the people by God. God doesn't just supply food for each day. In fact, we could argue that God, in fact, doesn't supply food for each day, because God instead provides that at least one day, the sixth day, the people need to take the long way around. 6 days, they're going to be able to gather. But on the seventh, they can search in vain and nothing will be found. Instead, what they're supposed to do is gather twice their normal amount on the sixth day. And where normally they try to stash anyway and find it spoiled, for the seventh day, it'll be preserved. It'll be usable. What's being built into the provision of daily bread, into the provision of manna, is Sabbath. This text comes before, by the way, the appearance of the law, the Ten Commandments, and the people at Mount Sinai. You'd think that God could relax the requirement of the Sabbath for hungry riffraff stuck in the middle of nowhere. It's the Sabbath, one day out of 7, when even the manna gatherers rest. Probably nothing proclaims our distance from God more loudly than our inattention to the mere idea of a day of rest. Even when we're off, we dash around, we catch up on email, shopping, we play frantically. A busy, busy day this Sabbath is. When God made everything, God rested and wired us with the provision to rest 1 out of 7 days. We think we know better, so we're all about producing, achieving, earning, making it happen. 7 days, not just 6. No wonder we're tired. No wonder we're clueless when it comes to grace. To rest, you have to have trust. You have to believe that it's not all up to me and my feverish activity. That's what this was about not gathering on the seventh day. There's going to be one day when you know it's not about you. It's not about your labor. It's not about your gathering. Anything else that you have done, it's only about God's provision. It's the ultimate attack on our belief in self-sufficiency. Be still and know that I am God. Be still at least one day and know that I am God and you aren't. Despite the desperation of the people, Sabbath is woven into the heart of this story. So the people are given something that resembles bread, but in many cases it ended up with no value to them at all. They went outside to look for it outside of their instructed time. There's nothing there. There's nothing of value. When they kept too much, it disappeared, and it had no value. When they hoarded more than they needed, it rotted, and it had no value. When they were caught in their own web of self-sufficiency, greed, and anxiety, their food, the very bread of heaven, had no food value. And that's still the way it is. Bread or anything else we want to claim for ourselves, when sourced in our own sense of self-importance, self-sufficiency, anxiety, greed, has no value in life. And so now we have the pieces to put this puzzle together. God hears and God responds. God gives, but the gift is a bit unknown. God's gift is really something ordinary. There's enough, but not more. And no matter what you do, you aren't changing that. So what can we take away from this text today? How do we truly experience the gospel in this text? We recognize that for each of us, it's not about us. We recognize that for each of us, we need to know that we are not enough. We'll never be enough. We'll never do enough. But God is enough. Can we be content with daily bread? Can we accurately perceive an emptiness in ourselves and then look to God to fill that emptiness? Greed, anxiety, self-sufficiency are nothing more than a perversion of our desire for God. We're trying to fill ourselves with what is not God. And we're killing ourselves with a sense of spiritual malnutrition. Deuteronomy interprets this text for us and that tendency. He humbled you by letting you go hungry and then feeding you with manna, a food previously unknown to you and your ancestors. He did it to teach you that people do not live by bread alone. Rather, we live by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. This verse is calling our attention to follow the divine law and teaching, yes, of course, but also we need to note the creative power of the Word of God that brought all things into creation. And it still sets them in order. It's a sad irony that craving a superabundance of stuff in order to magnify our own worth creates an actual diminished dignity of who we are. In our eyes, maybe in God's, the people began with a false memory. The things were good in Egypt. Moses' answer was to show them the truth. God had given them bread. If we zoom out for just a minute, we find the end of this text calling the people to collect a supply of this manna, keep it in a jar, place it in the place of worship. They do this so everyone through all the generations would know the truth of their experience, what God had done for them with the manna. Every home has this kind of museum piece. In our house, we have a box that contains everything from outfits from when our children were babies to some of their favorite toys to Katie's first point ballet shoes to Alex's first lacrosse helmet. It tells the story of who they were, who they are, and who we as a family have been. Churches are no different. A church has a podium, perhaps made from a column from a burned-out sanctuary. Maybe they have a cross made of redwood from old windowsills. This is what the jar of manna meant. It tangibly memorialized a real experience with God. I can't help but think of so many people in our congregation right now who are experiencing upheaval and uncertainty. This story gives the promise of God's wondrous provision. And that's reassuring to all of us. And I think it can also serve as a guide to let the rhythms of our observance, daily prayer, searching the scriptures, weekly worship, bring order to the chaos. Which brings us to the table in front of us today. God promised the Hebrews that were traveling across the desert that they would have food, and they would have it in abundance. They wouldn't go without what they needed. The bread on this table reminds us that God promises to give us all the things that we need. All the things that we need to live today and every day. Not just food, love, forgiveness. The gifts we need to do God's work. The manna story is not about what people are eating. It's about God's trustworthy generosity, tangibly memorialized when we come to the table. Daily bread. The gifts of God for the people of God.
Let's continue to prepare our hearts for the Lord's Supper. Let's continue to hear the Word of God through song and through Scripture. Hebrews 10:22 says, "So let us come near to God with an honest and true heart. Let us come near with a faith that is sure and strong. Our hearts have been sprinkled. Our minds have been cleansed from a sense of guilt. Our bodies have been washed with a pure water. Let us now draw near to God." There is a table and some bread beyond the veil, God's holiness. A priest alone must satisfy, and so he brings a sacrifice. Here I come, O Lord divine. I bring the blood that saves our lives. Accept this sacrifice for sin and draw us nearer once again. Draw us nearer once again. There is a table and some bread. Jesus now must leave his friends. A sacrifice on Calvary's tree. From the cross he makes this plea. Here I come, O Lord divine. I give my blood that saves mankind. Accept his sacrifice for sin and draw them near once again. Draw them near once again. There is a table and some bread, remembering the blood you shed. I willingly lay down my life, for you are living sacrifice. Here I come, O Lord divine, I plead the blood that saves my life. Accept this sacrifice for sin and draw me near once again. Draw me near once again. Please join me and sing. Draw me nearer, blessed Lord, to the cross where thou hast died. Draw me nearer, nearer, blessed Lord, to thy precious bleeding side. Here I come. I plead the blood that saves my life. Accept this sacrifice for sin and draw me nearer once again. Draw me nearer. Draw me near.